Your healthy radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Welcome, America. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. I'm so glad you're joining me today. Let's call this Reverse Racism Thursday because we have something very big to deal with here. Hillary Clinton's persistent charges that this country is guilty of systemic racism. In fact, we are all beleaguered by reverse racism. We've got a great lineup for you today, starting in this hour with Dr. Sam Clovis, policy head for the Donald Trump campaign, and later in the hour, the superb economist Larry Kudlow. I am so glad to be with you, and I hope that you're going to join me by calling in at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. So first in the headlines, the Broadway hit Hamilton put out a casting call for cast members as the show heads out onto the road to do a North American tour. And the casting call called for non-white applicants only. Non-white applicants. Can you imagine? This is a show about one of the great founders of America, Alexander Hamilton. But whites need not apply. Imagine if somebody were doing a show about Martin Luther King and said all cast members have to be whites, no blacks. That's exactly what this is. And we're dealing with this not just on Broadway. We're dealing with this in college applications where whites and Asians have to earn hundreds of points more on their SATs to compete with black and Hispanic and other applicants. We're dealing with it in the workplace now where the Equal Opportunity Commission, which is about anything but equal opportunity, is now insisting that employers report their workforce pegging each person into a racial slot. And then, of course, the employer will be evaluated on whether he or she is promoting enough blacks, enough Hispanics, enough transgenders, you name it. Never mind merit, never mind earning your way to the top. I'm going to boycott this Hamilton show. I don't know about you, but I sure don't want to spend my hard-earned money supporting reverse racism. Americans have to think twice about whether they will go to a show where whites need not apply. Now, I'm really excited that Dr. Sam Clovis is going to be joining us. He is the policy head for the Donald Trump campaign. He's an Iowan. I've known him well. He was a college professor, a member of the United States military, a proud veteran, a very, very knowledgeable person. And I have a long list of questions to ask him because the real news, the substance about the Donald Trump campaign, is not getting out. The mainstream media are so committed to obscuring the meaning of this campaign behind a smokescreen of trumped up, pardon the pun, trumped up controversies. From my point of view, this show, we're trumping and cruising. And don't listen to what the elitist in Washington and the European snobs are telling you about American politics. American politics has never looked better than it looks right now because we, the people, are speaking rather than getting pushed around by the elites. Dr. Clovis, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How are you doing today?
Oh, it is so nice to hear your voice. What part of the country are you in today?
Well, actually, I'm in Washington, D.C. today.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate, but we'll try to overlook it. That's a beautiful city, but as I always tell my children and grandchildren, bad things happen in those beautiful buildings.
Well, everybody's on vacation this week because the children are out for spring break, so the traffic is pretty good, and it's a relatively quiet city, and right now it's really beautiful because all the blossoms are out. So there are some aesthetics here that are pretty nice.
But, they really are.
You're right. We're better off if Congress stays home. So that's the best thing.
That's right. Let me start with the substance, because unfortunately, too infrequently, the campaign is able to actually zero in on the substance of what Donald Trump is offering this nation. And I was speaking with Larry Kudlow over the weekend. He came to Easter dinner, and he's a very noted economist. And he says that Donald Trump's tax plan will bring tremendous movement of capital and labor back to the United States, that his corporate tax plan will be a job booster. Will you please comment and tell us more about it?
Absolutely. I think that the one of the things, I'll just give some context here, during the John Kennedy proposed tax cuts in 1963, and before he, after he was assassinated, LBJ saw those through. So I'm going to give you two instances, the Kennedy tax cuts and the Reagan tax cuts, and tell you where we are today. The Kennedy tax cuts led to 4% growth in GDP for 15 consecutive years. The Reagan tax cuts led to 3.9% GDP growth for 17 consecutive years. The current situation in the last term of the Bush administration and all of the Obama administration, GDP growth has been 1.38%, which is not the new normal and cannot be. So what we're looking for is we had a plan that we're looking for to generate at least 4% GDP growth, because that seems to be the healing mechanism. And this tax plan we have will do that, and it will have 4% growth for the foreseeable future. For every percent of GDP growth over and above what the norm, what the average has been, will bring in an additional $3 trillion in revenue over the 10-year period. So we are looking at, right now, an additional $6 trillion in revenue simply just coming into our coffers and through our personal and corporate income taxes. If we have the corporate tax reforms that we're looking for, which means repatriation of $2.5 trillion of offshore money, come back at 10%, that's $2.5 trillion to be invested in this country, and also a then corporate taxes of 15% with all the loopholes taken out, special interest carve-outs taken out, we'll be looking at a substantive incentive for companies to stop the inversion process, come back to the United States, because the best workforce in the world is here, and we will start to see job growth numbers and all of these other factors that will lead us to where we'll have a comprehensive immigration reform to bring people to this country legally to work. So all of these things being in place will lead to phenomenal growth. And we actually see at the end of 10 years a $7 trillion surplus as opposed to what has been projected, and that's a $10 trillion deficit. We're looking at this as a much more optimistic and much stronger position, and we'll start to fix a lot of the problems that we have in this country by growing the GDP out past the debt and actually being able to start reducing the debt.
Which would be wonderful, because according to the Congressional Budget Office's latest report, which just came out last week, they are forecasting a $29 trillion debt. Can you imagine? We'd never be able to pay that back.
We're on that path.
Right. It would reduce
We're on that path, Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
We are.
Mm-hmm. So let me just focus on one part of this. We have, in the United States, the highest corporate tax rate in the world. So
right.
It's right. Not a surprise that companies are leaving. In Connecticut, for example, we've lost many, many jobs as companies have left. Some have just gone to lower tax states, but others have left the United States. And we see that everywhere. They're going to Mexico. They're going to Asia. They're going everywhere. And if we reduce that corporate tax rate, which is now very high, close to 40%, and bring it down to 15%, right. That's what Mr. Trump is suggesting, correct? 15%.
Right. That's correct.
Right. And 15%. That's 15% for all businesses, regardless of their size.
Well, including any business that you may operate, that I operate.
Right, so that's a big tax break. Yeah,
that's,
for
that's
anybody who has a little home business. Yes. That's literally slashing
absolutely.
Our taxes into less than half, right?
Exactly, and because, you know, my marginal tax rate that I pay, and I've been looking at this, they pay on average has been running around 25% for federal with my wife and me. And what we're looking at would be an incredible tax boon for us because most of the money I make comes through my LLC. And so we're looking at those kinds of things. So individually, I see how this will work. And also, what you have to take a look at is the idea of what foreign direct investment will come and follow with that. Because we would then be competitive with the best workforce in the world, the best infrastructure in the world. We would then have the ability to start to attract businesses from overseas to come and invest in this country wholesale. And foreign direct investment is also part of our gross domestic product, which is really an important element when we start to take a look at this. GDP is not the do-all, end-all as far as an economic health indicator, but growth in the GDP and healthy growth in the GDP really is a strong indicator that we're doing well.
Right. Now, I want to jump to a couple of other subjects, but I had to get this one in first because it's being obscured by all the manufactured crises of the moment. Right. Let's go to one that I keep hearing about all the time. This Whoopi Goldberg on television and so many other people, all these agitators, are accusing Donald Trump of being a racist. Now, I've gone back, really gone back in detail, looking through all the press clips to find any time when Donald Trump has made a racist comment, and I can't find one.
Well, it's not the idea. They're not branding him a racist because of his comments. They're branding him a racist because he wants to control immigration into this country. They're branding him a racist because he is looking for people to accept personal responsibility for their actions. And we have a government that won't enforce the law. And so if because we want to enforce the law and we want to establish a rule of law in this country, and if that is what many of these people on the left construe to be racist, and it's not racist at all. Because the law is colorblind. And this is what Mr. Trump is advocating, is to make sure that we have in place a system where we will have the ability to enforce the law. And that's all we're saying, is enforce the law. I just want to give you an example. I drove in this morning into Washington, D.C., and I had an immigrant to this country who was the driver, a Somali. And he was Muslim, and he wanted to ask me what I was doing. I said I was working for Mr. Trump. He was effusive about the fact that what Mr. Trump was saying about immigration was absolutely correct, because he says you cannot enter this country. This country has a big heart. He was talking about the notion that this country is a place that accepts people, but you have to come here the right way, and you have to come here legally, because if you come here illegally, or if you slip through the cracks and come here to damage this country, you hurt people like him. And I thought that I could not have come with better testimony about what this is all about than a person who has lived through all of that strife and turmoil, come to this country legally, is a practicing Muslim, and absolutely supports Mr. Trump 100%.
Well, that's good. And it doesn't surprise me at all, Sam, because I hear it all the time. And the same goes for African Americans who are Americans by birth. I say, are you for Mr. Trump? Or I just say, for whom are you voting? And again I hear, I'm for Trump because I want a better job. I want a prosperous America. And so when I hear people like Hillary Clinton or Whoopi Goldberg and so many others accuse Donald Trump of racism, I'm saying, where's the proof? There isn't any.
There isn't any. No. And it's not there. And again, it's just the leftist babble. And it comes from the fact that because he is politically incorrect on many of the things that he says and talks about, which is frankly refreshing to most people, he gets branded a racist because that's their definition. You have to remember, when a person calls another person a racist, it is to suppress their voice. They do that to suppress their voices, because when you roll out the race card, that is probably one of the most highly charged words that we have. If you call someone a racist, you're trying to get them to shut up. That's what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the time we have left, I wanted to ask you about Corey Lewandowski. I know Corey personally. I have a great, very high opinion of him. He is such a gentleman. And so I was shocked that this prosecutor in Florida was actually going after him and bringing a misdemeanor charge against him for his interaction with Michelle Fields, such as it is. And I wanted to point out to the audience that this prosecutor is actually in the tank for Hillary Clinton. He is a member of Hillary Clinton's, quote, leadership council in Florida, and he's donated $1,000 to her campaign. He should have recused himself from the beginning. This is a stacked deck.
I think you're going to find, you're going to find this whole thing is a setup, and I won't comment on the case or anything. Corey's lawyers can do that, and so, but the issue is that we point out these issues, and I think people can make their own judgments about where this is going. And I really think that it really is beneath comment, frankly.
I can comment because I'm not part of the campaign, and I want to say that I was very impressed when Mr. Trump said he stands by. He said, quote, I stand by my people.
Absolutely.
Very few politicians do that, Sam. They throw them under the bus. So kudos to Donald Trump for standing by his people.
Absolutely. No, he's a great individual to work for, and I'm very proud of my association with the campaign, and I feel humbled every day that I get the opportunity to be part of something historic.
Well, we're humbled that you're with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sam Clovis from the Trump campaign. We are trumping and cruising here today. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Welcome back, Bubba. It's so good to have you with me today. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And we've got some callers, so let's get started. Robert in Florida. What's on your mind, Robert?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I don't mind the continuation of trickle-down economics, but remove the loopholes. Remove all that stuff first, because if we look at the Pew Institute and the Brookings Institute, talk about actual wages of the working people, they haven't gone up.
I agree with you.
No benefit. There's absolutely no benefit in the world to continue the trickle-down when it's not actually trickling down.
I so agree with you. Middle-class people haven't gotten a wage hike in over a decade. And that's why we need to flatten the tax code, really simplify it so much that you don't have to hire an accountant to go do your taxes. There's something very un-American about the fact that people can't even do their taxes anymore. But reducing that corporate tax rate and the individual tax rate will, in fact, produce more revenue and, more importantly, more growth and higher earnings for people across the board. Thanks, Robert. Okay, we've got Len from Maine. Len? How about Frank?
Oh,
Len, are you on?
Yeah, hello.
Are you on?
Say it again. I'm here. I'm ready.
Okay, tell me what you have. We only have a second, but I want to hear from you.
Oh, okay. We're online now?
Yeah, why don't you wait till after the break, because we've used up your time, but we so want to hear what you have to say if you don't mind waiting. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham.
America is still the best country, and that's without a doubt.
You can take that to the bank. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham, your healthy radio addiction. So glad you're with me today. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And joining us now is one of my favorite political pundits because he's so smart, and he's going to give us straight talk on what's going to happen at the Republican convention and perhaps this week in Wisconsin. John Fun, columnist for the National Review, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, the American Spectator. He has written for all the big names. John, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Betsy.
Oh, well, it's great. Today, first of all, I want to ask you something about the Democratic side, because more and more Americans are feeling the burn. And yet it seems as if the deck is stacked against Bernie Sanders because the Democrats have so many of these super delegates. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, even though they call themselves the Democratic Party, democracy is a little bit wanting there. I mean, Bernie Sanders is now off the Washington, D.C. primary ballot because the Democratic Party forgot to submit his registration for the ballot.
Oh, can you imagine?
Now, obviously, this will go to court, but it's no accident, comrade, that this happens. The superdelegates, which Hillary Clinton has cleaned up on, are basically there to prevent the Democratic primary electorate from making what the leadership thinks is a mistake. And they're not going to vote for Bernie Sanders. If Hillary Clinton has any problems, it's not in the Democratic primaries because the superdelegates will basically carry her over the finish line. It's in the final primary. You know what that primary
is called?
Wait a
minute. It's also with the FBI.
It's the FBI primary.
Right.
And the FBI primary is a closed primary. Mm-hmm. It's held in one office in Washington, and
yes,
there's only one voter.
Oh, yes. James Comey. Hello?
Yes.
So the
real problem that she has is we now learned from David Schuster, a journalist on Al Jazeera, that her interview with the FBI is coming up in the next few days. Her aides are going to be interviewed. This is the final stage of the investigation. And she's got a lot of explaining to do.
She must be wetting her pantsuit.
Hillary's a cool customer.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I live in New York. She had her hair done at Bergdorf Goodman.
Oh, I read about
yesterday.
That.
The traffic was incredible. I'm sure glad I was walking.
Well, before we even go on, you know, she's billed herself as representing the middle class. But let me see here. She paid $600 for that haircut, $600 more for color, right?
Why would you criticize
I do my color in the bathroom.
Why would you criticize Our Lady of Chappaqua?
Oh, well, because she was pleading poverty when she left the White House, and she claims to be speaking for the common man. Look, I don't begrudge her $600 haircut, but, you know, putting on those airs of being part of the commonry, it's a little fake.
Well, let's just say that the reason that she does not want to debate Bernie Sanders in New York City is he can stand up on the stage and say, just a few blocks from here is Wall Street, and we all know they gave you $250,000 a speech. What did you tell them? Why won't you release the transcript? So
right.
She does not want to debate in New York City.
Plus, Bernie does his own color.
Bernie is colorful in every way.
Right. Okay, so back to the issue. It appears as if the Democratic Party is lacking in that spirit of democracy.
Yes, and the Republican Party to a lesser extent.
Yeah.
By the way, did you know that the Democratic Party rules have an interesting provision for delegates that Republicans don't? Democrats have a rule saying no delegate has to vote for any candidate on the first ballot unless if they cannot do so in good conscience.
So, in fact, these primaries and caucuses, as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, are just show. Because
not completely. But if the leadership wants something different, the leadership will get its way. And, of course, that's what the Trump people are claiming is going to happen in the Republican convention as well. And they have some validity to that, but much less than the Democrats.
What worries me on the Republican side is I hear all these insiders talking about the tricks they're going to use. First of all, they can rewrite the rules when they get to the convention.
I can safely say that the following needs to be understood by everybody. Every convention has its own set of rules. No rules carry on to the next convention except
mm-hmm.
for one, which is you need a majority of the delegates. That rule has been in effect since 1856. Lincoln followed it. Eisenhower followed it. Reagan
right.
followed it. But all the other rules are adopted for that convention. I don't believe the Republican Party wants a bloodbath or a civil war or the riots that Donald Trump referred to happening in Cleveland. I think that they're going to make sure that they don't change the rules very much, except in cosmetic ways. What I think the real issue is going to be, between now and June 7th when the primaries end, will Donald Trump get enough delegates to have an actual majority, not just more delegates than any other candidate? That's going to be the battle. Anything else that happens at the convention is going to be settled after the first ballot then.
Mm-hmm. And you know that if he doesn't get the majority on the first ballot, nobody who's an insider at that convention is going to help him succeed in a future ballot.
The best guess is that a whole bunch of Trump delegates will be people who are bound and pledged to vote for him on the first ballot, and they will do so, but they probably have other candidates that they're more interested in on the second and third ballot.
Mm-hmm. Because the delegates are actually chosen by the political insiders in most party, in most states, correct?
Or at the state convention where party activists show up. I wouldn't call them insiders, but they're certainly people who have been loyal to the party for many, many years. And, you know, that's not the Donald Trump electorate. The Donald Trump electorate, to its credit, is a new force in the Republican Party. These are people who have been tuned out of the political process or feel disillusioned, and they're just not as well organized as the people who normally show up at state conventions.
Well, also, up on Drudge today, there was a headline that 180,000 Pennsylvanians have registered with the Republican Party to vote in their closed primary in Pennsylvania. And my question is, are those independents and Democrats who want to vote for Trump, or are they people who want to mess up the Republican process?
I would say far more people who have been Democrats in name only for a long time, and they've decided that Donald Trump is somebody who speaks to their concerns, to the failing coal and steel industries in Pennsylvania that have put a lot of people out of work,
mm-hmm.
and they probably really want Trump. Now, of course, the interesting thing is Pennsylvania's delegation is mostly unbound. In other words, no matter how people vote in that primary, the delegates are going to go to the convention, and the vast majority of them will be able to vote for whomever they want.
Wow. Now,
those are the rules.
Those are the rules.
Those have been the rules for a long time.
Uh-huh. But what are your thoughts on delegates being chosen by the political insiders, like the chairman of the party in the state, rather than by the voters?
Well, look, I think there's an argument in the modern television age where every state is a primary or a caucus. You know, why do we need conventions anymore? So there's an argument that maybe we should have, you know, regional primaries, and that should determine the party's nominee. But this tradition of gathering together 4 years, so everybody gets to know each other, everybody meets, you know, it's hard to get away from that. I do think the biggest problem Donald Trump has, though, is not the party insiders. It's his own mouth. You know, somebody compared his problem today to a mountain climber climbing a mountain. He's picking up rocks at every step of the way, which makes his difficulty in reaching the top all the more a problem. In other words, he's not losing the altitude that he's already gained in climbing the mountain, but he's making it a lot harder to reach the top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think, though, that it's also the case that the media are explosively covering the little things and ignoring some of the policy points that Trump has made so impressively? For example, many, many economists say that he has the best tax plan.
Well, taxes are not on the front and center of voter concerns. I mean, if
you got to be kidding. People want jobs.
Yeah, I understand that. But if Donald Trump wants to showcase his tax plan, I haven't seen it. Have you seen Donald Trump hold a single news conference on his tax plan?
He has. And in fact,
since he announced it, has he held a single news conference on it? Yes or no?
No, he always includes it in his speeches.
He barely references it. Look, I'll be honest with you. Donald Trump says lots of things, and he sometimes will change his mind very quickly, and he returns to his, I think, very important points about trade and immigration, but he doesn't talk about his tax plan except in passing. And
mm-hmm.
I watch every one of his news conferences, and if he wants to focus more attention on his tax plan, he has a way to do that because they will cover anything he says because it's ratings gold.
That's a good point. In fact, the first question I asked his policy person, Dr. Sam Clovis, this morning, was about Donald Trump's tax plan, because I had dinner with Larry Kudlow on Sunday, who raves about Trump's tax plan as being the most promising.
Well, what is Donald Trump saying in Wisconsin? He is going out and criticizing Governor Walker for not raising taxes in order to cover the state's deficit. Now, excuse me, you can't have it both ways. You can't have a tax plan that's talking about reducing the burden on American taxpayers
right.
and companies, and at the same time going out to Wisconsin and criticizing Scott Walker, of all people, for not raising taxes.
I hadn't heard that, although I am familiar with the fact that they have a big deficit out there, and of course states
No, they actually don't.
Oh, they don't. Then why should he?
Well, because Donald Trump yesterday gave an interesting statement. He misstated the size of the state's debt by 2/3, and he said unemployment in Wisconsin was over 20%. Well, I was just in Wisconsin, and those are manifestly untrue. One of the problems Donald Trump is having is he goes into a state, and frankly, he doesn't study up enough on it. And in Wisconsin, you saw the poll yesterday, he has now fallen from 20 points ahead to 10 points behind.
Yeah, and what do you think is going to happen in Wisconsin?
Well, I think Wisconsin is a state that's just not, you know, in Donald Trump's wheelhouse, because even though there's a lot of blue-collar and union workers there, he has angered a lot of Republicans there by trashing, of all
their
things,
boy.
Scott Walker's,
yeah.
Well, and his union reforms. He said Scott Walker was too inflexible with those unions. He should have sought harmony. Excuse me, when you're changing things like, you know, the compulsory taking of union dues for politics, you can't have compromise with unions. Scott Walker stared down the unions. He endured massive demonstrations, a recall. Now there's harmony in Wisconsin because, frankly, his reforms are taking root and saving people money. But Donald Trump criticized those reforms and criticizes Scott Walker for not raising taxes. So he needs to study more what the political landscape of a state is before he enters it. Otherwise, he's just going to run into a buzzsaw of people who say, do you know what you're talking about?
So on the Democratic side, it's also kind of a nail biter there, right?
Well, Bernie Sanders is ahead of Hillary. He's ahead in Milwaukee. He's ahead in Madison, Wisconsin, which you know is, you know, to the left of Columbia University.
Hardly possible, but maybe.
Yes.
Right.
And so I think Bernie Sanders may well beat Hillary, which just goes to show Hillary Clinton may drag herself across the finish line because of the party establishment and the superdelegates. But the heart of the party is with Bernie, and Hillary has had to move way to the left to be close to Bernie in order to even get the nomination.
And tell me, if Hillary gets the nomination, assuming she's not indicted, and all these Democratic voters are disappointed, are they going to stay home?
Well, that's unclear. It depends who the Republican candidate is. I would say this. Both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz might be very strong get-out-the-vote motivators for Democrats. But the real problem Hillary has is, look, she's not going to be indicted, Betsy. What would happen is the FBI report would be sent to the Justice Department. It would, of course, leak. And then the Democratic leadership would sit there and watch the polls. If Hillary dropped 10 points because of the revelations about her national security problems in the report, they'll dump her and they'll replace her with Joe Biden. If they don't fall, they'll
Joe Biden, not Bernie Sanders.
The Democratic leadership is absolutely convinced that the American people are not going to vote for someone who is a self-proclaimed socialist. And the reason why Joe Biden didn't run last year is he was told, keep your powder dry. If Hillary gets into trouble, we'll parachute you in at the last minute.
Well, you've heard it from the man who knows the most about what's happening behind the scenes in American politics. John Fund, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, and I'm at nationalreview.com, and my Twitter handle is @JohnFund.
Great. Glad you gave us that information. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Just try to make our dream come true somewhere.
Oh, so glad you stayed with me. It's Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. We are trumping and cruising today, looking ahead to the primary in Wisconsin and then, of course, to the big election in November. Some say the most important election in at least a generation. But on the line with us, we've got Len from Maine. Len, thank you so much for holding. I promised you your time, and please say what you have on your mind.
Okay, Betsy. First of all, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I admire what you did exposing Obamacare. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Great. But what I wanted to talk about was when I heard somebody talk about that Alexander Hamilton play and whites only apply and this and that.
Yeah.
It struck me. I just wrote a book that puts a good perspective on our culture and our music. It's about somebody who most people, virtually nobody heard about anymore. She's like almost the mother of American music, Teresa Vaughn. She died in 1903. But it's the most amazing understanding that I got. She was all over the place, all over America, in England. She was very big on Broadway. She was at the very peak. Our culture reached a peak We came up from the colonial times all the way up through, and by the time we got to the 1890s, 1885, I would say, is when American music and American culture and the whole scene was really great. It's like, you know, when Donald Trump talks about America should become great again. Well, we really, most people don't understand when was it, what was it like, and why was it great, and what was it like. Most people, they don't go back that far. But if this book is by, it's about Teresa Vaughn. It's a very interesting thing. It tells about, really shows the beauty and the sensitivity of that time. And here's what happened. All the problems that we have right now, this thing that you talked about with the no whites only, and all the liberalism and all the progressivism and all the everything, every bad thing that's going on right now, it all had its roots way back around 1900. The culture is like a tree that bent to the left.
Well, Len, we're going to look for your book. Give us the title. The title of your book, please.
The name of the...
Just give us the title. We got a break.
Okay, just go to teresavaughn.com. It's all there.
Thank you so much for calling in. And we've got Todd from Georgia. Quickly, Todd, what's on your line? What's on your mind? Please hold, Todd. Right after the break, we will be calling on you. Todd from Georgia. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram.
You're healthy. Radio. Addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingram Show.
I grew myself across America from sea to shining sea.
Welcome back, America. All across America, we are trumpin' and cruisin'. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. And today we're celebrating American politics. Yes, I know the Washington insiders say it's a disgrace, and the European snobs say, look at those Americans. But the fact is, we the people have taken the political process back, and we ought to be proud of that fact. So we're trumping and cruising and celebrating the fact that the outsiders are in the lead. With me on the line now is a famous supply-sider, Reaganite, economist, one of my favorite people, a personal friend. You see him on CNBC. You hear him on ABC Radio. He is the best, Larry Kudlow. Larry, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Betsy. How are you? So I just want to know, are we trumping or are we cruising?
Well, you know, I'm giving a little time to everybody, but we had Sam Clovis from the Trump campaign on earlier to set the record straight on some of the brouhaha. And now we've got you here to set the record straight on the most important issue, which is how to ensure that Americans earn more money and get to keep it in their own pockets.
Yep. That's the key point right now. It's not the Federal Reserve. It's not this and that. I really think it's fiscal policy, and I think in the middle of that is tax policy. And most importantly, the single most pro-growth, pro-wage thing we could do would be to slash America's high and uncompetitive business tax. That's the single. We're asking our companies to pay 40%. The rest of the world pays about 25%. I'd like to see it drop down to 15% for both large and small businesses. And if you put that together with immediate write-offs for new investment, new business investment, and stop double taxing overseas earnings, you have a really terrific boom. Capital would flow to the United States. Trillions of dollars of capital would flow to the USA from all over the world. We wouldn't have to worry about China or anybody else. And meanwhile, we'd start investing again. We've had almost no business investment, Betsy, in 15 years. And the middle-income wage earner, who would be the biggest beneficiary of this, has not had a raise since 2000, since year 2000, and that has to be changed. And I think the key is a supply-side tax cut for business. I think it's the most important thing.
And Donald Trump's tax plan includes just that cut, correct?
Yes, it does. Trump has a very good tax program, tax cut program. Hardly anybody ever mentions it. It could do with a little bit of tweaking around the edges. But the basic point is he's on the 15% rate for the large C-corps and the smaller pass through S-Corps or LLCs. And people, he should talk about it. I mean, he's gotten in all these flaps in the last week or two. He ought to get back on message. Here's how to help middle-income workers. Here's how to help grow the economy. Here's how to increase wages. Growth, growth, growth. That's, you've never heard me say this before. Growth, growth, growth. Get on message, Donald. I mean, it's really important for him to do so.
I never get tired of hearing that message. And the fact is that everybody who's worried about what kind of jobs their own kids are going to get wants to hear that message. Growth, growth, growth. If we don't have growth, we don't have jobs.
That is correct. You know, it's a simple formula here, which Democrats don't get, because both Bernie Sanders and Hillary, who's kind of Bernie light, they want to raise taxes on capital gains. They want to raise taxes on businesses. They want to increase health care costs. The list goes on and on and on. Here's the deal. If you don't have a healthy business, you are not going to have good, dependable, well-paying jobs. It's just that simple. You can't have a job without a business. Obama didn't understand that. Hillary doesn't understand that. Bernie Sanders doesn't understand that. And let me add one more quick thing here. You can't start up a new business unless you have the investment or the capital to do so. So if you're penalizing investors and you're penalizing businesses, that means you are penalizing workers. So let's get with the drill and open the doors, deregulate wherever possible, and lower these business tax rates. They lead to jobs and consumer spending and to family income. It's so darn simple. But right now, the GOP, as you know, is so off message. My God, nobody's even talking about this stuff. You know, we've got sex, drugs, rock and roll, wives, God knows what. Most of this stuff is X-rated. Let's get back to growth, 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 growth.
I so agree. And of course, the media just play into that with they love these manufactured crises, whether it's Corey Lewandowski or the wives or whatever it is. But most of us just want to hear how we can have a more reliable source of income and more opportunity for the next generation. I'm dumbfounded by the fact that people aren't just rising up and demanding this, because when you hear Hillary and Bernie talk, they're only talking about increasing government revenue, taking more of what we earn and then redistributing it to the people who aren't working.
Well, you know, their model here is the president. God bless him, right? He takes a big picture in Cuba in front of a gigantic mural of Che Guevara.
Oh, God, isn't it?
A communist killer, literally a communist murderer. And secondly, Obama goes to Argentina, talks to a bunch of college kids and says there really is no difference between communism, socialism, and capitalism.
Can you imagine? When I saw that, I thought, this is incredible. Right. Take. He said, take what works from each one of these systems. Can you imagine?
And apparently he doesn't know the difference or the history of what works and what didn't work. So I'm not accusing Hillary Clinton of being communist, but they are taking their cue with this very muddled vision, which, as you noted, is mostly a big government vision. They're going to take all your money, so you're not going to have any increase in after-tax wages. But the other point I'll make is on the campaign trail, Betsy, Trump and all these guys really need to talk much, much more about terrorism and stopping ISIS. This is really crucial. And for the life of me, I don't understand, number one, why hasn't the USA formally declared war against ISIS? ISIS has declared war against us. Why hasn't NATO formally declared war against ISIS? And number two, the new general in charge of the Middle East has got a great plan to bomb and with troops on the ground, special ops troops, to destroy Raqqa, which is the ISIS capital in Syria, northern Syria, right?
The president won't do it.
He won't do it. Good for you. He will not do it. The general has been rejected. And we are never going to – look, that by itself won't stop all terrorism around the world. But if we take the real estate away from ISIS and keep killing off their leaders, that will stop much of the planning and training and so forth that's gone on to these European attacks, as well as Turkey and Pakistan. Take the real estate away. Destroy the real estate.
And the oil.
The president doesn't want to move. Yeah, well, they won't let them take the oil, Chuck. There's a little bit – they're a little bit better about bombing oil, but you're right. They're too worried about global warming and things like
that. Is that a riot? Is that a riot?
it's a life and death issue. So if I were, you know, Senator Cruz and I were Donald Trump, I would be really hammering away at these issues. You know, growth, take-home pay, ISIS. That's, to me, so simple. Ronald Reagan used to boil things down into four or five major points and communicate with the electorate. So can we please get back to that? Because those are the mainstays of this election. And the GOP can win this, Betsy. Hillary is going to be a very weak candidate, but they've got to get on the ball here, and they're not so far.
I so agree. I hope they're listening to you. Now, I wanted to ask you about one other thing. You wrote a really terrific column, and you raised the issue of employee rights, that employees should have the right to decide whether they're paying union dues. And we know that we lost in the Supreme Court on that issue. So tell us how you would solve that problem.
Well, you know, I think, right, with the court at a standoff, 4-4, which does, in fact, protect the union since nothing's going to change, you know, I would move the debate, Betsy, to the state level, which in some respects is where it should be in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I would really, you know, as conservatives, I would have people really work hard at the state level. There are a lot of states right now are right to work, or as you put it, employee freedom, worker freedom, including, of course, Scott Walker in Wisconsin. There are a lot of states that would be surprisingly open to this, and the public unions, the government unions, depend on this vigorish. They depend on these dues, which do not help the employees particularly. They mostly go into political slush funds. So why not go to the state level? Let's just move this campaign for the moment until we get some advances on the Supremes. Let's just go to the states. Go to the governors, you know, take this case right to the governors and make it a big election year issue.
It would be terrific as a referendum on the ballots, never mind even having the state legislature vote on it. Just put it out there for the people to decide.
Well, if you can do that, fine. Most of these, the state legislature has to agree to put it on the ballot. But either way, I don't care. Go for the referendum approach. You know, in New York, for example, which is regarded as a very pro-union state, on the other hand, workers have suffered enormously in New York down through the years. Most of upstate New York, as you know, is still in a recession and has been in a recession.
That's a kind word for what's happening in upstate New York.
So you've got three or four decades of recession. I'd like to see this campaign come to New York. Worker rights, worker freedom. You don't have to give paying a dues if you don't want to. It should be up to the individual person. That's called freedom. I'd like to see it here in these Northeast states, Connecticut also. I think it would shake up everything. You know, you were talking at the top how the outsiders seem to have the whip hand. Well, this would be a great issue for outsiders.
What's your call for the New York primary?
What's my call? Is that what you're asking who's going to win?
That's right.
Judging from the polls, as we speak, I think Trump wins it easily. Walk away. It doesn't mean he will. It doesn't mean polls are right. But this is a Trump state, obviously. It's his home state. And I have not endorsed Donald Trump. I have endorsed his tax cuts. But I haven't endorsed any candidate. But I'm just saying that I think Trump has done an awful lot for both the city and the state of New York down through the years. A civic-minded guy, a philanthropist, as well as a builder. In fact, some people think he's helped to rebuild the face of New York City. Steve Quazzo of the New York Post has been writing about this. So I think this is a Trump state. That's what I think.
All you have to do is drive up and down that big highway on the west side of Manhattan and see what used to be a slum has now turned into a long line, 10 or 12 beautiful Trump buildings. It's restored that whole neighborhood, brought all kinds of businesses to that part of town.
That's exactly right. And it's very important. And, you know, when you and I were kids growing up around here, remember the Wollman ice skating rink?
I was just going to say he knows how to take a completely defunct public project and turn it around literally overnight.
I know, a couple months. So, you know, hopefully he'll talk about stuff like that and not get trapped into statements about abortion or reporters or women or other things. Just go. You know, this is such a clear case of the importance of bread and butter issues.
Yes.
Just stay on message.
Well, you certainly do. We are so glad you came on today. I wish you were running for the United States Senate in Connecticut. The nation can use your leadership. But in the meantime, all over America, people can watch you on CNBC and hear you on ABC. Thank you, Larry Kudlow.
Thank you, Betsy. Take care.
That was really interesting. So he hasn't endorsed Donald Trump, but he has certainly put his name on Donald Trump's tax plan. And I have to tell you, I am convinced this is a really, really good tax plan, which will bring jobs back from all over the world. Companies that have been dissuaded from doing business in the United States because of the very high corporate tax rate here will come home and do business where they should be doing business, right here in the United States of America. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back after the break. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Of all the sweethearts I've yet to meet, well, I finally chose an American Beauty role.
Welcome back, America. It's Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction, and today we are trumpin' and cruisin', celebrating American politics as it is, driven by the people, not the insiders in Washington. And we have Todd on line two. Todd, thank you so much for waiting. You've been patient, and we're eager to hear what's on your mind.
Yeah, I just had a question regarding Ted Cruz and this story in the Inquirer. I was wondering if you've heard if he's filed a libel lawsuit against them.
I don't know whether he's filed a libel lawsuit, but I can tell you that the National Enquirer has one of the biggest legal law firms, legal teams of any publication in America. And it is really hard to sue them because they phrase things so carefully to make themselves immune from litigation, even while they're saying things that would make your hair stand up. So good luck suing the National Enquirer.
Well, it might look better for him if he at least, you know, filed it.
Yeah. Trouble is, it's a distraction. It's another day's news story when you file that suit, reminding everybody of what was said in that newspaper. And sometimes it's better to just move on and have a thick skin. But thanks so much for calling. We've got Marilyn on line three.
Hi, Betsy. I want to just first off say that I love it when you do a guest appearance on Laura's show.
Oh, that's so nice, Marilyn. Thank you.
Yeah, well, and I agree with you. I think John Bolton is the perfect choice for Secretary of State.
Yes, let's keep our fingers crossed. He is really marvelous.
He is. But the reason for my call is my husband and I have been diehard Republicans for over 40 years. I worked the first time around when President Reagan was elected. I worked on his campaign. And we have just been very loyal, very faithful. No more. No more. I have called Speaker Ryan's office. I get a short little window of opportunity to leave a message. I've tried to call Mitch McConnell's office for about 3 weeks, and you know, every time I call, they're having an overload of calls and cannot take mine.
No kidding. Well, that's exactly
Absolutely.
The message that these Washington insiders have been sending. Don't call us, we'll call you. And of course, they only call you for money. They don't call you for your opinion on anything meaningful.
I can't tell you how many requests for donations I receive every week from the Republican Party. And just yesterday, I got a plea from Paul Ryan. I almost cannot see the difference between the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. They're almost unified.
Well, many of us are distressed, not with the party, but so much as with the Washington insiders, the McConnells, the Ryans, the Boehners, who go along to get along and sell us down the river. Really, they aren't representing what we stand for. So I am so glad to hear from you, Marilyn. You hold to your principles, and let's hope that this time we elect a president of the United States who really represents us and will do what he promises.
If the Washington insiders will allow it.
Right, you bet. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. More after the break. 855-40-LAURA. 855-40-LAURA. From the East Coast to the West Coast, thank you for joining us today. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram. And we are trumping and cruising, celebrating freedom and the fact that the people of the United States have finally seized the political process from the insiders. On the line with me now is one of the smartest women in America, Heather McDonald from the Manhattan Institute and the City Journal. And she is, more than anyone else I know, capable of diagnosing what ails our universities and our legal system. Let's start with the latter, our legal system. Welcome, Heather.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Betsy. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, I'm looking at this recent news story in the New York Post. It was also covered in the Wall Street Journal that the Attorney General of the United States, Loretta Lynch, has sent a letter to municipalities all over the country telling them not to enforce low-level ordinances because by doing so and imposing fines and other penalties on people who break local laws, it's having a disparate impact on people of color. It kind of reminded me of the civil rights edicts that say we can't maintain a discipline in the public schools because it appears that more often minority children are suspended or punished in some way for behaving badly in school. And that can't happen under an Obama administration. Tell us where we are on this.
Well, Betsy, like everything about the criminal justice debate, so-called debate we've been having in the last year and a half, this is all driven by race, as you say. What the Justice Department has done is sent out a very strong letter of warning to court systems across the country saying that they cannot imprison somebody for a repeated failure to show up in court or pay fines for offenses, traffic offenses, graffiti, urinating in public, marijuana arrests. You can't imprison somebody for those non-payments or just completely brushing off your court duties unless you have made sure that the defendant is not so poor and that the poverty is preventing the payment of the fines. Now, in theory, this sounds reasonable enough. I mean, we don't want to imprison people for poverty. But judges are already making those determinations. And what this is doing is really allowing a repeated irresponsibility. People are simply failing to show up in court. They're brushing off their obligations. And the Justice Department is basically saying, well, you cannot use the ultimate tool that you've got to try and get somebody's attention, which is to throw them in jail for a few days. And this is all driven by race. The fact is that blacks commit crimes at much higher rates, and that includes low-level public order crimes. And you can talk to minority judges, and they'll say, I can't get people to obey my orders. The Justice Department is assuming that judges across the country, white and black, are driven by racial animosity. In fact, most of the time, they just are trying to get people to obey the law.
It's disturbing to me when I read this because it sounds as if what's going to happen is that you have to obey the law unless you're a minority. Then it's the minority community that suffers the most with this kind of lawlessness. They're the ones who live in neighborhoods where people are urinating on the street.
Of course. I mean, there's no question that the law-abiding residents of poor communities want public order enforcement. And empirical evidence has shown the broken windows theory, which holds that low-level crimes increase public fear, they drive people out of public spaces, and they can lead to greater levels of law-breaking. There's been some very beautiful experiments that have been done that show that, in fact, environments where they're covered with graffiti, trash, encourage people to break other laws. So this is a real phenomenon, and we should not turn away from enforcing the law simply because we think it has a disparate impact on people of color. Because, as you say, Betsy, it is crime that has the worst disparate impact on people of color, not law enforcement.
Well, and also this kind of lawlessness makes public housing uninhabitable.
The biggest crimes in New York City, the most violent, are committed in public housing. And years ago, tenant councils were adamant about having the police there and enforcing low-level offenses. They didn't want drug dealers in their housing. But you had the ACLU come in and said, oh, well, this is discriminatory. And if a grandmother has her drug-dealing son who's walking around packing heat living with her, that would be discriminatory and unfair to evict him and her. And so instead now you have public authority, housing authorities that are terrified to do anything, and it absolutely reduces the quality of life there to worse than nothing.
Okay, now we've got to shift gears because I have to get your take on something else, and that is what's happening on our college campuses. I've got stories here about Emory University, about Stanford University, where these groups of students are occupying offices and staging protests to demand that the university disproportionately hire more black professors, more Hispanic professors, offer more minority courses. Whatever happened to going to college to learn something new?
Well, now the latest demand is amazing, that and deans at Brown University and elsewhere have backed this, that minority students are so stress-filled by doing their social justice protesting that they should be given free passes from taking exams. That they are under such stress in trying to create safe spaces for themselves and their fellow sufferers that they need counseling and they need extensions on term papers and exams. It is quite extraordinary. We seem to be entering a degree of insanity that is just going to spin off into outer space. There's been no effort on the part of college presidents or administrators to push back against this epidemic of self-pitying narcissism. To the contrary, the college adults encourage it because there is a symbiosis, a codependency between self-dramatizing, self-pitying, delusional students and the ever-growing student services bureaucracy that caters to these little psychodramas of victimization and oppression that students spend all their time acting out now instead of studying for exams, because it increases the bureaucratic fiefdom. And these adults who should understand that there has never been a more privileged group of human beings in human history than college students, American college students today, who have the resources of thousands of years of civilization at their fingertips, free food, free everything. Instead, these presidents are encouraging them to think of themselves as victims and thereby unfitting them for adult life.
They're groveling. That's what they're doing. Groveling university, I would call it. And I sent my three daughters to college, but I can tell you I wouldn't do it if they were college age now, because parents who are saving up to send their kids to college are really getting ripped off. Instead of having their children educated, exposed to rigorous learning, exposed to subjects that they haven't taken before, instead, their children are being sucked into this political correctness that is overcoming any respect for learning.
Exactly, Betsy. I mean, this has a political dimension, which is it is increasing the divisions and victim mentality in this country. That is one thing. But I agree with you, the worst sin that is being committed by colleges today is that they are betraying their obligation to preserve the beauty of Western civilization and world civilization. Professors should be down on their knees before these great works of literature and art and architecture and philosophy that is their privilege to curate. And instead, they are wasting their time and students' time by cultivating this victim identity, by going approaching these works with a chip on their shoulder, looking for signs of sexism and racism, works of such grandeur and elegance and intelligence that no college professor could possibly devise on his own. And yet, students are being taught to look down on it because it does not match their race, gender, and sexual preference.
It's really shocking. And now we've got the ultimate example in New York City on Broadway with the show called Hamilton, which I brought up at the very beginning here, is just sent out a casting order. Hamilton is going on the road all across North America. And this Broadway musical put up a casting order. They want only non-whites. Now, this is a story about Alexander Hamilton, but only blacks and Hispanics are welcome to participate in this production. It would be like making a presentation on the life of Martin Luther King and saying whites only.
Well, I haven't seen Hamilton, and I've finally heard some critical commentary about it. There seems to be unanimous acclaim. I think what it is trying to do...
People are afraid to say anything else, Heather.
Well, that well may be. But I think I would hope that what it is trying to do is make the argument that Hamilton's legacy of limited government and a constitutionally restrained government should be the legacy of minorities as well. I would hope that it is being subversive in a good way. But yes, yeah, certainly, you know... Well, that's nothing compared to the pressure on the Academy of you know, cinema to say, well, we have to have color coding in films as well.
Right. And, of course, students at all these campuses are intimidating the administration into saying, we have to have a certain number of black professors, Hispanic professors. We have to get rid of Shakespeare and only have African-American literature or Hispanic literature or whatever. It's bizarre.
Well, what you have is a demand to ignore the pipeline. It is ludicrous to think that you are going to have a racially or even gender proportional chemistry department or physics department when you look at who's graduating with PhDs, especially graduating with PhDs from highly competitive colleges and at the top of their class. And so what is happening with this pressure that is fully agreed to by the administration. I mean, at this point, by now, the administration has been completely turned over and is fully on board the diversity madness. In order to meet those diversity quota demands, you have colleges turning away from the most qualified candidate simply in order to get a female in the electrical engineering department. I have many friends at UC San Diego, other places that have been told in no uncertain terms by their dean that they have to reject their first choice for a new hire in favor of female candidates who are much more mediocre than the ones they would choose. And so this country is basically committing scientific suicide. Our only hope is to export gender theorists to China as soon as possible, because so long as they remain committed to meritocracy, that's the only thing that matters in science, is whether you've got the intelligence to do the equations.
That's right. It's the right answer. Thank you very much. We've got to say goodbye to Heather McDonald, but she has laid out these issues brilliantly. I hope you'll join us again soon, Heather. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Welcome. Welcome back, America. I'm so glad to be with you today. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. And we've got John on line 8. John, tell us what's on your mind. Oh, how about Sonny on line 6?
Good morning, Betsy. I refer back to your first guesses and the fact, as the fact that's going on here with this 0.1% interest, while the Fed under Bernanke and Yellen have pumped billions into the Wall Street crowd, the inner circles there, and made billionaires out of millionaires. Example, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, who in 2013 lost $6 billion. He's now a billionaire. As a senior citizen, my income goes down every year.
I am with you entirely. I went to the bank the other day to just get my tax documents on how much interest I've earned. And you might as well not put your money in the bank. The interest rates are so low now. They're practically charging us to put the money in the bank.
I believe they will be. They're trying to do that in Europe now. But anyway, that's beside the point. My point being is, when do we get an American Congress and people willing to represent Americans rather than refugees, foreigners, illegal aliens, and themselves?
I am so with you, Sonny, on this one. And the fact is, the Fed has really screwed the average John Q. public. These negligible interest rates mean that savers, people who have that great habit of saving for the future, are being penalized because they can't earn any interest. And of course, that very, very low interest rate is the cruelest tax on seniors. So I'm with you entirely on that one.
My point being is, seniors used to be able every 6, 7 years, maybe 10 years, go out and buy a new car or
right.
take that cruise or go on a trip. Where do you go with $300 worth of interest?
I so agree with you. Let's hope we can fix that. It's a real penalty, particularly on seniors, but on all savers. Thank you so much for calling. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. After the break, the star of all stars, Ed Klein, author of Blood Feud, and his latest book on Hillary.
Radio Addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingram Show.
Everybody trying to find a way to have a good time.
Oh, we're having a good time. Welcome back, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. So glad you stayed with me. And we have on the line now a very special guest. I've waited all morning for him. His life is the epitome of the success story. He started out as a copy boy at the New York Daily News and rose to become editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine. He's written many, many books, all of which have appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. The last one I read was called Blood Feud, The Obamas and the Clintons. And I'm telling you, I've never had so much fun reading a book in my entire life. And he has a new book out. It's called Unlikable, The Problem with Hillary. So here he is, Ed Klein. I have so many questions to ask you, Ed. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Betsy, it's great to be with you, as always.
Thank you. Well, first of all, this new book, it's out, right?
Yes, it's been out for some time. It was a bestseller, and it's doing very well.
Oh, that's great. And you can get it at Amazon, at Target, at Barnes & Noble. I can't wait to read it. And the first thing I want to ask you is, you label her unlikable. Does Bill like her?
That's a great question that nobody has ever asked me. And I'll tell you the answer, and this is not based on my opinion, but based on reporting, is less and less. And that says a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, they've had this marriage, which I don't have to go into. We all know it's been a marriage of convenience for 30, 40 years. But they have drifted apart in the last several months because Bill and she, number one, don't see eye to eye ideologically. He's much more centrist than she is. She's way over on the left and always has been since Alinsky and Truhoff and her early days at Wellesley College. And secondly, she's no longer listening to him. He's kind of apoplectic about this, I'm told by his friends. He calls her, gives her advice, and she basically just says, and hangs up and doesn't listen. So they're living, even now, more separate lives than they have up to now.
And it's been pretty separate. According to Blood Feud, it was pretty separate for many, many years.
They're hardly ever in the same place at the same time. And when they are, they sleep in separate bedrooms and have for 20 years or more. Bill spends a huge amount of time down in Little Rock, where he has his library. And on the fifth floor of the library, which is the penthouse, he has a luxurious penthouse where he throws parties quite frequently.
I'm sure there's something else.
And so, when she goes to Little Rock, guess what? She doesn't stay with him in the penthouse. She goes to a hotel and stays at the Capitol Hotel down there.
Really? Isn't that amazing?
It really is amazing.
Okay, now the other question that everybody wants to know, and you will know this better than anyone, is she going to be indicted?
Again, I'm working on a new book, and the book is, of course, concentrating a lot on the FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton. And it is my conclusion, based on talking to FBI and Justice Department people, that Comey will, in fact, recommend within the next, I would say, 6 weeks or so, that Hillary be indicted on several counts, not just one, including perhaps even corruption in terms of pay for play with giving special favors to foreign governments and foreign businessmen in return for donations to the Clinton Foundation. And, by the way, lying to the FBI, which is a federal offense.
Mm-hmm. Now, when he makes that recommendation, officially it's secret, but will it leak?
I think so. I think there's going to be a lot of leaks because, as much as Comey says that he doesn't give a rip, as he puts it, about politics, and he's not going to be pushed around, which I think is true. He's kind of like the Elliot Ness of our time. He's untouchable. He's above reproach. That's no doubt about
that. I've heard that from many people. You're right. Right.
But on the other hand, he's also aware that he's got to come to a conclusion on this thing well before the convention so that the FBI investigation doesn't hobble our political system. So I think what will happen is that almost as soon as these referrals, as they're called, to the Justice Department for indictments take place, that there will be leaks about this because there's going to be a lot of pressure on Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General appointed by Barack Obama, to follow through and do what is right, which, of course, is to indict Hillary.
But will she do that herself, or will she try to sidestep that?
I think she's going to sidestep it, Betsy. I think she's. I've been told that they've been talking about appointing a special counsel, not prosecutor, but that's because that's out of the books, off the books now. There is no such thing as a special prosecutor like Ken Starr anymore. There's no law for that. But there is. She has the right to appoint a special counsel. However, she was appointed by Obama, and she's going to appoint the counsel. So whether or not politics can be separated from this legal situation, that's a big question mark.
Well, even if she isn't actually indicted, wouldn't the recommendation itself her unelectable?
I know. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think you're absolutely correct that the fact that we will hear through leaks, which I'm sure will happen, that the FBI believes she's guilty is going to be a huge blow. But to her and her prospects for running for president. But whereas Bill Clinton and his legal advisors are telling her, listen, you're in deep trouble, you've got to do something about this. You should have an attorney talk to the Justice Department and try to, you know, get this to be a lesser charge. She is saying, I am told, by her associates, bring it on. Literally, those are her words.
Wow.
Let them bring it on, because I've been through this before. I've beat them before. They're never going to get me. They've tried to get me. You know she's paranoid. You know that. And it's I'm going to have 16, 18 million votes in the primaries, and that's the democratic process. And an indictment is only a charge, and I don't think she's going to step aside.
That's amazing.
I think she's going to run, even if indicted.
Even if indicted. And you think that the Democratic Party mechanism would permit that?
Well, the question is, who controls the Democratic Party mechanism? And in my view, the Clintons have essentially, I don't know if the word stolen is exactly the right word, but believe me, Barack Obama does not control the Democratic Party mechanism. If anyone does, it's the Clinton operation through its appointments at the very top of the DNC. And I think that it'll be very hard for the party to force her out. Now, I have friends who totally disagree with me, by the way, and they think if she's indicted, she's a goner. But that's not what she's saying, and I'm only reporting or telling you what I hear she says. I'm going to go and run no matter what.
Well, that would be very lucky for Donald Trump, right, if she's facing these charges, even if it's just a leak from the FBI that she should be indicted. That makes her a far less formidable opponent to someone like Donald Trump.
I totally agree. I think if she's indicted, she's already a weak candidate. I mean, I think you and I could agree on that. I mean, if Bernie Sanders is giving her a run for the money, for crying out loud, you know, then you or I could give her a run for the money.
Right.
But I think you're right. If we know that the FBI thinks she's guilty, she's going to be a very weak candidate. And I think the election is going to be a really dirty and confused, maybe a kind of a unique election. If we have an indicted Hillary Clinton and a Trump who is very, very controversial running against each other.
Well, and Trump has said, quote, I haven't started on Hillary yet. So what do you mm-hmm. foresee?
Well, up to now, I think the Hillary people tell me that they would prefer to run against Trump than anyone else, because to get elected, in their view, you need the woman vote, the female vote, because 54% of the vote in 2012 mm-hmm. was a female vote, not the male vote. The minority vote, which Trump is going to have a lot of trouble with. In their view, I'm saying the Clinton people now, Trump would be an easier candidate because he, in their view, has disaffected the core vote in so many states.
Now let's get into it down and dirty. What's so unlikable about Hillary?
I've given that a great deal of thought, and I think what we all know, sense, feel, and have come to the conclusion about is that she has no moral center, that she does not understand the difference between right and wrong. Given a choice to do the right thing or the wrong thing, she often does the wrong thing. She not only skirts illegality, she falls over into illegality time and time again throughout her entire career, starting from $1,000 cattle futures into $100,000 to the email scandal, and that is over a period of 30-some-odd more years. And so when it's more than that, she's a liar, she's a totally unprincipled human being. I would say, and I'm not a psychiatrist, and maybe this is the wrong word, but certainly psychopathy or whatever, psychopath or sociopath or whatever you want to call it, is a person who doesn't know the difference between right and wrong and is never guilty about it. And she fits that very much.
Certainly someone who can stand on the tarmac at a military base and look straight into the eyes of the parents of the victims at Benghazi and say it was a videotape.
Yes. And that's classic Hillary. She doesn't feel any sense of shame about any of this. You know, you and I'll speak for myself. I have in my life lied about things. Once, from time to time I've lied. I'm always embarrassed by it. I always feel guilty about it. And it gives me a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach when I do that. I don't think she experiences any of that at all. This is a woman who, from early in her career, has had only one thing in mind, and that is the advancement of her own ambitions.
And that is what has enabled her, for example, to testify through those 11 hours on Benghazi without flinching.
That's right. You never saw, she was the Secretary of State who knew that the Benghazi consulate was unprotected and understaffed, and it was her ultimate responsibility. Did you ever see her really show any sense of remorse? I haven't.
No. Well, I can hardly wait to read this book, Unlikable, The Problem with Hillary, on sale many places. I'm going to run out and get it. Ed Klein, thank you so much for joining us today. Woo! We learned a lot in a short period of time.
Thanks, Betsy. It's great to be with you. Let's do it again soon.
Absolutely. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, your healthy radio addiction. After the break, more calls, 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA.
The Laura Ingram Show.
And I'm an American woman, so glad to be with you today. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. And we have so many calls on the line. Let's start with George at Line 8 in South Carolina. What's on your mind, George?
Well, Betsy, I was calling you about the education situation. We'll get to that. But I have one question for Mr. Klein, next time you see him. Ask him. I can ask you, too. Security clearances. Now, when I went in the Army, I was a paratrooper, but my MOS was Signal Corps, and I was a cryptographer. I had to get a top secret clearance, and they went around my neighborhood and checked me out, and I was given the top secret clearance. Do they not clear the president?
That's a good question, because it's hard to imagine that Hillary would pass, right? Well, first of all, thank you for your service. And secondly, it's a very good question. I'm going to ask Ed Klein. He lives down the street from me. I often see him out on the sidewalk, and I'm going to ask him whether Hillary has ever had to get a security clearance. Certainly as First Lady, she didn't, but maybe as a senator, if she was on one of the top secret committees, she did. That's a good question. And what was your comment about colleges?
In a second. And also, does the president require, because our president now, I don't think he could have got a security clearance under the scrutiny that I went through.
Well, I will try and find out. That's a very good question.
Okay. The thing about the colleges, when I went to college, I went on the GI Bill. My tuition was $157 a quarter. I went to Central Washington State College out in Washington State. I'm from Boston. I went out there. I was married and had a child at the time, so I found an inexpensive school. And I remembered they just started to have offering black studies. This is Washington State, so you understand.
Yeah.
That they were pretty liberal in this. And the man never, I don't know whether he was qualified, or I guess he got the job. But the courses that they're teaching today, they're offering courses that are unmarketable. When will...
You're putting your finger on something very important. When will a college graduate be able to use this information?
Not only that, when will some good law firm or a lawyer start a class action suit against the colleges and universities for offering degrees that are unmarketable?
Yes, unusable. This is a very good point. And even before the class action suit, I'd like parents to get more involved in what majors their young people are choosing, because when you spend all that money sending your kid to college and then they come out with some major that is totally unrelated to anything, I mean, it's very discouraging. Thanks for calling, George. How about Don in Indiana on line two?
Hi, Betsy. I'm upset with all the people that are putting their lust for an insurgent candidate ahead of their conservatism and their pragmatism. And I guess I want to ask all those people, if we get to the convention and Trump has the most delegates but doesn't have the required number, and he's losing to Hillary Clinton by 25 points in the polls, are they really prepared to go down with the Trump ship in that case? Or aren't we better off finding a candidate that can win?
Well, I'm glad you expressed that opinion. I'd like to answer you, but I hear the music in the background, so that we're coming up on a hard break here. Thank you, Don, and maybe after the break we'll talk about that. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, your voice of liberty. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. Thank God I'm an American. I feel that way every day. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And we had a very interesting caller before the break, Don, who said, well, what's going to happen if Donald Trump receives the most delegates before the convention, but not a clear majority? In other words, a plurality, that's a mouthful, but not a majority. And the fact is that has happened many times in history. And every time a plurality has not been enough, it's gone to a second, third, fourth round of voting. In fact, even in 1860, Abraham Lincoln won on the third ballot, even though a rival for the nomination, William Seward, had captured 41.5% of the delegates on the first ballot. So the first ballot is not decisive unless it's a clear majority. It's always been that way. And it appears as if Donald Trump will have to win a clear majority on the first ballot to become the nominee, because so many of the delegates who would be committed to voting for him on the first ballot may not be willing to vote for him after that. They're insiders, and they come from states where the powers that be would prefer to shift the vote to somebody else. So that's the best answer I can give you. But I recommend also that you listen to John Fund next time he's on. I try to always have him on the show because he knows the ins and outs of these rules very well. And we'll ask him. We'll ask him again. We have some other callers as well. Vicente, or Vicente, I hope I pronounced that right, sir, from Iowa.
It is Vicente. Thank you for taking my call, Betsy. Hey, I just wanted to mention that I'm an immigrant. I became a United States citizen in 2008.
Well, welcome.
Thank you very much. I love the Constitution. I love, and I'm happy to be an American. One of the things that we as conservatives fail to recognize, which I don't understand, why is it that we are up in arms when we hear all of these things that are taking place under the Obama administration? Because he promised that there was going to be a fundamental transformation of this country. And I mean, when you look at the grievances for which our founding fathers separated from Great Britain, I mean, the abuse of executive powers, I mean, dictating pretty much everything from his seat. Everything is an executive power, executive decision, targeting the Tea Parties just because they were patriots. The abuse of judicial powers, may I say, Obamacare, everything dictated by the Supreme Court. Our Supreme Court is not made to make laws. Congress is supposed to make the laws. So I'm not surprised that everything that is taking place under this administration is taking place because of the fact that that's what he promised, and everything starts from the top down. As far as the Broadway
just let me interrupt you for a moment. I want to congratulate you on your grasp of the United States Constitution. If only all Americans knew as much about the principles of our system of government as you, a newcomer, does. So thank you very much for taking the time and thoroughly understanding what our Constitution says. Go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much. And as far as the Broadway show that I heard is going around where only blacks are accepted, that to me, in my own personal opinion, is as bad as the signs that you still see in documentaries where down in the South on the drinking fountains were for whites only. And then if you notice and pay close attention, everything is by Democrats, because all of this racism that started back when the KKK was founded in 1866 by Nathan Bedford Forrest, you know, the KKK was a right-wing group of the Democratic Party, and these people have racism inbred into them from the time that they are young. And I'm starting to see a very clear difference between us as conservatives and liberals. I mean, they always are claiming that, oh, we are very good to people, want to be good to people, but in reality, they just want to handicap us as citizens so we can vote for them. In reality, they are now for America. They
yes.
are for an elite group.
Well, I'm really glad you called about this. And when I see Hillary Clinton's current campaign, she is running a very racist campaign. Race is the number one issue she brings up all the time to divide us, claiming before large groups of people, she says that they are victims of systemic racism in this country. I simply don't see that. And I think when she's stoking the feelings of divisiveness, stoking racial resentment, instead of trying to bring us all together, it's very unfortunate. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you. So I'd like to hear what you think about this. Who do you think better represents American unity, tolerance, and pluralism, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party? Now we have on line one, Joyce. Joyce, what's on your mind today?
Yeah. And then you go down to Lake Street.
Joyce?
Right.
I don't think we're hearing Joyce too well. Well, this is a very troubling topic. When I see on our college campuses the emphasis on racial differences, gender differences, ethnic differences, instead of educating all the young people on campus on the common cultural heritage that we have. What a shame. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our next guest, our final guest. It's a real treat because he is so knowledgeable. Ambassador John Bolton, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, former ambassador for the United States to the United Nations, the most knowledgeable person on American foreign policy. Thank you, Ambassador, for joining us.
Oh, glad to do it, Betsy. Always glad to be with you.
Okay, so here's my first question for you. Ronald Reagan, a hero to many, many of us, always preached peace through strength. What has happened to our country?
Well, Barack Obama believes almost essentially the opposite. He really, if you look at how he's performed over the past 7 years, it's clear that he thinks that American strength and our determination to protect our people and our country and our allies around the world is a big part of the problem. So that if America doesn't act from a position of strength, if we don't protect our citizens and our interests around the world, that will actually make the world a more peaceful place. I mean, I think that's like looking at the world through the wrong end of a telescope, but I think that's his view of things. And the consequence is we have spreading anarchy across North Africa and the Middle East. The terrorist threat internationally is growing. The Russians and the Chinese are acting belligerently in Eastern Europe and the East Asia, respectively. And our ability to look out for our country around the world is diminishing. So it really is like flipping Reagan on its head.
Do you think that the Republican candidates are making enough of national security as an election issue?
I wish they would do more, because I really think the people are out ahead of their leaders on this. You know, for many years, Republicans were unwilling to take Obama on his failures internationally. I think that's changed in recent years. But if you just look at the continuing threat of Iran and North Korea's nuclear programs, the president today in Washington is having what he calls a nuclear security summit. And it's, it's largely a propaganda exercise. It's a charade. It masks the real inaction of his administration under this fog of rhetoric, which is what he does, which he's always most interested in. And yet at the same time, we can see that the proliferation threat, and it's not just nuclear weapons, it's chemical and biological weapons that could fall into the hands of terrorists, is spreading. So that we have not just most recently the tragedy in Brussels at the airport last week, but the next time or the next time it'll be a tragedy where it's not just suicide bombers, but it's people using weapons of mass destruction.
And what about ISIS?
Well, this is a threat that's manifesting itself in Paris, in Brussels, in San Bernardino, and the president says his goal is to destroy it. It's not like he's not willing to say that. He's just not willing to do what's necessary. And so, as long as ISIS has a privileged sanctuary, whether it keeps its territory in Iraq and Syria or whether it's somewhere in North Africa, as long as they have these base camps to indoctrinate people with their terrorist ideology, to train them in terrorist techniques for use in Europe or the United States, and to gather resources to send them on their missions, they're going to be a threat. And it really, for Americans, the question is, do you want to defend always at the very last place that it's possible with the TSA inspectors or magnetometers at the entrance to the Capitol and other public buildings? Or do you want to prevent these people from having the capability to attack us in the first place? That's the real issue. And I think the only, we need to take a lot of safety precautions for many reasons. But to say that we can ignore what the terrorists are doing and building up basically safe havens for themselves overseas is just to invite attack as far as the eye can see.
It seems as if the campaign against ISIS is just in slow motion.
Well, it is in slow motion. That's exactly right. And the consequence is that, we see in just this week extensive reports in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times about the networks that ISIS has developed all throughout Europe. We've seen some evidence of this in the bombings in Brussels and Paris, and that's what's allowed the uncovering of just at least part of our knowledge of just how extensive these networks are. But let's be clear, we're kidding ourselves if we don't think those networks aren't being built in the United States too. And so it's easier, obviously, geographically. Europe is closer to the Middle East than the United States is. They've had the chance to develop these no-go zones, as they're called, in the Molenbeek neighborhood in Brussels, in the suburbs of Paris, and elsewhere around Europe. But the risk is that they're going to bring those same techniques here. And I just hope that we can debate this in the coming election, because I think Americans actually believe the president's first duty is to protect the country.
Of course.
And the politicians that can make that case, I think, will be successful. I just hope we don't have a wake-up call of another tragedy, maybe not of the scope of 9/11, but one where worse than San Bernardino. The evidence is there if we just connect the dots.
Well, and it does seem as if we already have some of those enclaves, like the little Mogadishu enclave of Somalis, where Hillary Clinton made a very important campaign announcement recently. In other words, there is an issue here of large groups of immigrants coming in from these countries and failing to show any interest at all in becoming part of America.
Yeah, I think, look, I think our success as a country, as much as anything else, is due to our melting pot tradition. We take people from all over the world, and we've learned how to assimilate them. They don't cut their ties with their culture or their language or their relatives, but they become Americans. That's what E Pluribus Unum means, out of many, one. That's our motto, and that's what has been the engine for our success. When people reject the basic freedoms that we have here, refuse to assimilate, it's a risk for everybody. And the Europeans don't have a comparable melting pot tradition. I think that's one of the reasons they've had so many problems. We need to learn from that lesson. It's very clear that we should not abandon precisely the formula that's made our country a success.
Right, and strong. In closing, let me just ask you about something America hasn't focused on much, but could be important to us, and that is Great Britain's decision on whether to leave the European Union.
Yeah, this is a critical point, and you're right. It's not one that many Americans have paid close attention to. But, you know, the European Union has become a stifling statist enterprise. It once started out as a continent-wide free trade zone like the United States. Economically, it makes a lot of sense. But many of the proponents of the European Union have had another agenda, and that's to subsume the different countries of Europe into the super state that they're creating. Britain is the first one to have a referendum on whether to withdraw. I hope the voters of Britain do vote to withdraw, because I think Britain will be stronger outside the European Union than it is inside. And the United States needs strong European partners. Right now, the European Union is less than the sum of its parts. That's dangerous for Europe, obviously, but it's dangerous for us, too. So this is something that in Britain, I think the refugee crisis in Europe, the tragedy in the Brussels airport, these attacks all around the great cities of Europe, it's going to have a big impact on them, because they see that if they don't take steps to defend themselves, they're going to be just as vulnerable as what we see on the continent of Europe now.
Thank you so much, Ambassador John Bolton, the expert on American foreign policy. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. We'll be back after the break. 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Thank you for staying with me, Bubba. This is Your American Girl, Betsy McCoy, standing in for Laura Ingraham. Our show is just about over, but we've got Steve on the line from Texas. Steve, what's on your mind?
Thank you for allowing me to participate. First off, I'd like to send out a mazel tov to Vicente, because it sounds to me like the U.S. gene pool is much better off for his citizenship.
Amen. I agree.
Secondly, conservative media, I listen to a lot of conservative media, and they've reported that there are in the vicinity of 600 emails between Secretary Clinton and Ambassador Stevens regarding the weak security at Benghazi Annex. Now, whether it's, I don't know how we really determine how many it is, but whether it's 600, 60, or even 6, given the potential, and I think it's generally accepted.
Quickly, because we're about
to
break.
Much easier to attack, to hack that server. Is it possible, likely, or any other speculation that the terrorists were made aware of the security deficiencies?
Could be. Could be, Steve. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Betsy McCoy standing in. Please remember, freedom isn't free. It's up to you and me. I'll be back tomorrow standing in again for Laura. Please join us.